Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
About a year ago, I had the honor of being invited to the Princeton Theological Seminary to attend a colloquium on religious freedom that was sponsored by the good folks at the Witherspoon Institute. I should mention as a side note that it is Princeton Theological Seminary's bicentennial this year, so a big happy birthday shout out to all you Presbyterian Tigers. The colloquium was designed to bring together a number of scholars, commentators, and policymakers to comment on the ongoing work of the Witherspoon Institute's Task Force on International Religious Freedom. There were some heavy hitters at that workshop, including Princeton professor Robert George, National Review columnist Catherine Lopez, Angeline Wu of the Beckett Fund, Hudson Institute scholar Paul Marshall, Abdullah Saeed, an outspoken advocate of freedom in the Muslim world and a distinguished professor at the University of Melbourne, Pew Foundation researcher Brian Grimm, and the famed scholar and commentator Michael Novak. I was there to represent the dumb redneck constituency, and I did that well. Now, over the past year, I've had the opportunity to interview a number of the folks who were in attendance there, including the director of the task force and former diplomat, Professor Thomas Farr, as well as scholars Justin Barrett, Margarita Mooney, and Dan Philpott. We'll link to all those interviews on our website so you can peruse them at your leisure and get an idea of what they said at that conference. Today, though, in celebration of the release of the task force's publication on religious freedom, I want to interview the lead author of that report, Professor Timothy Shaw. Tim is Associate Director of the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, a visiting assistant professor in the government department at Georgetown University, and an all-around nice guy. He's also been associated with Boston University, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Witherspoon Institute. So basically, you cannot go anywhere on the East Coast without bumping into him. Professor Shaw is also the co-author of God's Century, Resurgent Religion and Global Politics, with Monica Duffy-Toff and Dan Philpott, both of whom we featured talking about this book during the past year. And if a book isn't enough, you can read many of Tim's articles on religion and global politics that have appeared in Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, the Journal of Democracy, the Review of Politics, and many other journals. Tim, thanks for taking the time to be on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you, Tony.
Hey, I need to ask you here. You're a Harvard graduate, and if I'm correct, right? And so how is it being hosted by Princeton? Was there this kind of rivalry?
No. I was not a big a follower of the Harvard football team, so I didn't hold any grudges against Princeton or any other team for that matter.
We have bragging rights this year because Princeton didn't make the NCAA tournament, but Harvard did. So
no, I didn't. see how closely I follow the Harvard team.
Okay, well, let's start talking about this report issued by the Witherspoon Institute's Task Force on Religious Freedom that was just published. The report is entitled Religious Freedom, Why Now? Defending an Embattled Human Right. Now, I want to walk through that report step by step since it is incredibly well organized. But first, I want to know what motivated this project, which gets to the whole why now question in the title, as well as how long you've been working on it and who's all been involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, the report emerged from a task force on international religious freedom that was sponsored very generously by the Witherspoon Institute at Princeton, in Princeton, New Jersey. And Witherspoon established this task force through the leadership of Tom Farr, my very close friend and colleague. He is the director of the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown, and as you mentioned, I'm the associate director, so we work very closely together. And Tom was asked by the folks at Witherspoon, including Robert George, to establish this task force about 3 or maybe even 4 years ago. And there were two motivations for establishing the task force. One, the sense that there is a massive religious liberty problem around the world, and increasingly in Western countries. This was, as I say, 3 or 4 years ago. A sense that religious freedom was being threatened in various ways, in life and death ways, in many parts of the world, but also in increasingly insidious and worrying ways in Western countries as well. So that was one motivation. The second motivation was, despite the growing threats to religious liberty, there was a sense that among many people, very well-meaning, well-informed people, there was just was not an awareness of these gathering growing threats to religious liberty, lack of information, a lack of understanding, a lack of appreciation of the importance of religious liberty. So the task force wanted to counter a response to both of these trends, as it were, a kind of a trend in the objective increase in threats to religious liberty, and a trend in the kind of the subjective, as it were, decrease or lack of concern concerning religious liberty, particularly among elites in Western societies. And so there was a sense on the task force that we need to put together a short, punchy manifesto that says religious liberty is important. It deserves attention, and here's why. And a report that would, in an accessible way, appeal to folks, not just academics, but educated lay people who were interested in learning more about the issue, and in the hopes that people who don't know about the issue, aren't sufficiently informed, would become informed and might be more interested in doing something about the growing threats to religious liberty.
And you did an extremely good job with that. I will link to this report on our website, and
great,
people can pick it up. It's a, as you say, it's a short, punchy, to the point
and
manifesto.
Only $5.95 on Amazon.
$5.95 on Amazon. So there you go.
You can get Prime shipping. So.
Excellent. So we'll send people that way on it.
And great.
It's not.
I don't get any profit from it.
Okay.
Let me emphasize. We literally don't. Don't make any profit on the book. We're simply trying to educate as many folks as possible
and get the word out. So yeah, definitely go check this out, because as you say, it is short, but it's filled with a lot of stuff which we're going to be talking about here today. But one of the things that you mentioned is that a lot of elites don't pay attention to this. There's either a lack of awareness, a lack of attention, because you're living in an academic bubble where this issue is not talked about. So that leads me to this question. How did you, an academic, become interested in the topic of religious liberty?
It's a good question, because I was sort of intellectually preoccupied with the 17th century, really, for most of my graduate career. And even when I was undergraduate, I had a deep interest in the history of political thought, and that's what I wrote my senior thesis about, or about John Locke. And my dissertation was about a Dutch legal philosopher, Hugo Grotius, founder of modern international law. So I was pretty much living in the early to mid 1600s in graduate school. But then, exactly 10 years ago, actually, this month, I was really stopped in my tracks by events that unfolded in India, and actually a part of India that my own father's family has direct ties to. So that's part of what made what was going on there compelling. And what happened, I remember this very clearly, because I happened to be on vacation and I was reading the newspaper every day, which I didn't normally do in the rest of my time in graduate school, but I had time on my hands, and so I was reading the newspaper, and what had happened is that in Western India, in the state of Gujarat, part of India that is actually very well developed, has one of the highest economic growth rates in India, very large middle class, there was a series of horrific attacks, religiously motivated attacks. First, there was an attack by a group of Muslims on a group of Hindus who were riding a train, and in response to this attack, groups of Hindus organized very systematically a massive counterattack, and literally in a number of cities in the state of Gujarat organized a pogrom, a systematic series of attacks day after day. It went on for at least 3 to 4 days. Often police simply stood aside while mobs of people, often actually middle-class Hindus, you know, themselves, on their own, organizing attacks on Muslim homes, shops, pulling people out of homes. Muslim women were raped. People were killed in horrible ways. People burned alive. And you know, the only reason that these people were being killed is because of their religion. And it shocked my conscience that people that, again, were well-educated people did this in the most systematic manner and deliberate manner. It also shocked me because I didn't really know very much about the political religious context. I'd actually spent time in India because of my family connections, but this was something that just completely came out of nowhere. For some reason, this series of events just kind of forced the issue of religious freedom into my consciousness. And when I got back to Washington, I was part of a think tank, the Ethics and Public Policy Center at the time, and I started calling people and expressed my horror about what was going on, and weren't other people concerned about it, and shouldn't there be more concern about what was going on, how innocent Muslims were being treated in India. And I was shocked, you know, first by the fact that this had happened, and my second source of shock was that there was so little concern about this in Washington at the time. I helped organize an event with the International Commission on Religious Freedom, or the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, rather, organized an event at EPPC. We brought over human rights activists from India and other prominent people to talk about this. There were two things that really kind of concerned me at the time. Again, this massive assault on religious liberty in the world's largest democracy, and ultimately more than 2,000 people were killed, but also this kind of deafening silence on the part of journalists, on the part of the Bush administration at the time, on the part of the kind of foreign policy think tanks in Washington. This sort of horrified me, and you know, it didn't matter to me who exactly the victims were. It was, you know, it just was horrifying to me that, you know, innocent people were treated the way they were simply because of their religious background.
I think that's a interesting personal story that you have to tell there, because it's things that interrupt our lives that oftentimes can direct our scholarship in very different ways,
yeah,
and some
exactly.
You weren't expecting. Yeah. But you said earlier that you were doing a dissertation on political thought or thinking about early 16th century, I should say early 17th century thought.
Yeah.
That brings me actually to the cover of the report here.
Mm-hmm.
Given the policy-oriented nature of this report, in that it's trying to influence public opinion, but also the policymakers around the world, it's unusual to see a painting on the cover of an event that dates back about 350 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah.
And specifically for our listeners, it's a picture of Mary Dyer, who was a Quaker in Massachusetts in the early to mid 1600s, being led to the gallows.
Yeah.
What motivated that cover design?
It was a very deliberate choice, and Tom Farr and our colleague at the Witherspoon Institute, Matt Frank, deserve credit for this. They and I heartily agreed. Wanted to emphasize through the cover that no country, no religious tradition has a monopoly on religious bigotry and on the scourge of religious persecution. This beautiful illustration hauntingly illustrates the horrible act of religious persecution that occurred on American soil. committed by, you know, people we revere, the Puritans who helped settle found our country. And yet these people had Mary Dyer, a Quaker, hanged publicly on Boston Common in June 1660 for no reason other than that she was a practicing Quaker. Colony had laws, very harsh laws concerning Quakers dating back to the 1650s, and if Quakers persisted in returning to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they could be punished with death. And this actually happened. And Thomas Jefferson actually, you know, all the way up to the late 1700s, writes in his notes in the state of Virginia that even at that time in the early 1780s, there were still not executions, but still very harsh treatment of non-established churches, Baptists and Methodists and so forth, people who were not part of the established church. In other words, you know, we perhaps think that, you know, we kind of, you know, have this, you know, wonderful history of religious freedom, but not that long ago, we were people that, you know, harshly treated religious minorities, and moreover, even very recently, and right up to the present time, you know, there are religious minorities in our country who are not treated as well as they should. Sikh Americans, for example, Muslim Americans, are facing various kinds of challenges. Mormons were treated extremely harshly in our very recent history, as Mitt Romney's own family can attest. So religious liberty is something that is an achievement that is hard won, was hard won in our own country, and it's also a fragile achievement. We shouldn't take it for granted. And we shouldn't be arrogant in assuming that, you know, it's something that we've cornered the market on.
Absolutely. It is a very salient reminder that religious persecution, religious discrimination is something that's been with us throughout history, and that unless we are extra vigilant of it, will continue to be present in history. And I think that your report goes a long way to keeping us vigilant in that regard. I want to go ahead and now work through the report itself. It's organized in a series of chapters that make the case for religious freedom from a number of different angles or vantage points, including moral justifications, political justifications, legal reasoning, and strategic dimensions. It also includes how three different religious traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, view the importance of religious freedom. But the report also starts out by defining religion from an anthropological and psychological point of view, so as to provide an additional justification for promoting religious liberty. I thought this was a brilliant chapter and a great way to start the report. Also, at the conference that we attended, I thought it was odd that we were dealing with the anthropological view of religion. I thought we'd just get right to the meat of the matter and start talking about religious liberty. But tell me why that first chapter deals with this ontology of religion and why that is important to the quest for religious liberty.
From the time that we started thinking about this, it just seemed to us that we can't really address the question of how important religious freedom is until we say something about the place of religion in human experience. In other words, you've got to say something about how important is religion. And partly because a lot of the elites that we were talking about earlier, increasingly in our society, as Christian Smith in his wonderful book on the secularization of American public life that she edited and other people have noted, a lot of our elites, you know, have the view that religion is something that belongs to sort of the infancy of human existence, that people, when they're immature and untutored, they may, you know, rely on religion as a sort of crutch, or they need it because they don't have a kind of rational scientific understanding of how the world actually works. And then once people are educated and once they, you know, achieve a certain amount of security, then they no longer need religion. This is, you know, as you know, this is argued by Ronald Engelhardt and Pippa Norris in their book on religion and politics also, based on the World Value Survey. You know, when people become existentially secure, they don't, you know, don't need religion anymore. And so there's sort of a view that religion is kind of artificial, that, you know, it's an artificial byproduct of certain human cultures and stages of development, but it's more natural for people to not be religious. That fully mature, normal people don't really need religion. Well, it turns out that there's a whole stream of new academic research, which is not at all the exclusive preserve of religious believers. In fact, a lot of people in this research are not believers, and some of them are even hostile to religion. But there's a whole stream of research called the cognitive science of religion. It's a full-fledged subdiscipline, essentially. And the main conclusion of this body of research, a lot of it is based on experiments with children, with interviews of adults as well, rooted in developmental psychology and experimental psychology. Some of it is based on evolutionary biology as well. So there are a lot of different disciplinary streams in this. But the bottom line of this work is that religion is a very natural part of human experience. That it's not something that appears irregularly or incidentally among people, but it's something that is pervasive in human experience. It's rooted in our cognitive makeup and equipment. It appears very, very early, very, very easily, and very naturally in children, for example. People don't need to be brainwashed or sort of artificially nudged in the direction of having religious beliefs, but people very, very easily and naturally have, for example, beliefs in supernatural agents. People, you know, naturally believe these kinds of things. So now that doesn't, of course, mean that these are good things to believe in or that they're necessarily true. And as I said, many of the people who practice the cognitive science of religion are hostile to religion. They're not friends of it. The point is, though, that we have every reason to think that religion is something that will continue to be a pervasive part of human experience. That it doesn't mean that it's inevitable. It doesn't mean that we're hardwired to be religion. It's not deterministic, as the work of Justin Barrett shows very clearly. But it does mean there's a very strong tendency of people to gravitate towards religious accounts of the world, religious beliefs, like beliefs in supernatural agents, so that there's probably good reason to think that it's unlikely that we would see, you know, kind of a total secularization of the world. And what that means is that religion is probably here to stay. Not that everybody's going to be religious, but that people are, you know, that a lot of people in a lot of places are going to be religious. This is rooted in who we are. We're it's a natural tendency, and that goes a long way towards meeting this skeptical idea that, well, religion is a kind of expensive, you know, taste that, you know, a few eccentric people sort of indulge in, and therefore it should be, you know, shouldn't be treated with anything, you know, with any special set of policies. Well, no, religion is very, very common. It's likely to continue to be very common, and therefore that means we have to sort of, you know, recognize that it requires some kind of response. That doesn't get you to religious freedom necessarily, but it says this is something that you've got to deal with.
Yeah, I remember listening to Justin Barrett at the colloquium at Princeton. And at first, my first thought was, oh boy, we're going to hear from a psychologist. But his talk really drew me in. It was one of the most interesting ones for me to hear about this innate tendency we have toward religious belief. And subsequently, I tracked him down and we got him on the podcast. I'll link back up there for
great.
Some of our listeners.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing that I got out about this that made a lot of sense why we had this at a religious liberty conference is that if there is that innate tendency to have spiritual belief, religiosity becomes something very personal to the human, and denying somebody the ability to express that would be like denying somebody to have arms or legs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it in many ways takes on that personal moral imperative that we as a society need to respect. And that brings me to the next point that I want to cover here. Which your next chapter actually goes into the political case for religious liberty, but I want to come back to that, and I want to skip on to the moral case mm-hmm. that you make, because religious freedom is frequently framed in terms of a moral imperative, and I think rightly so. From all the input you received on this report from a number of different sources, what is the strongest moral case that can be made for promoting religious liberty?
I think it has two parts, the moral case. One part is that religion, understood as the human search for some kind of understanding and harmony with the widest superhuman source of existence, understood that way, religion is a basic human good. So that doesn't mean that there necessarily is a superhuman source of reality, but anyone thinking clearly and coherently about what opportunities present themselves to one's reasoning as someone possessed of freedom and reason, anyone thinking clearly and coherently about those opportunities has to think that it would be better if one had some understanding and some meaningful relationship with ultimate reality. All of us, whether we're religious or not, understand that having some access to, some understanding of, some clue about, some hint of insight into ultimate reality would be a very, very good and important thing to have. We have that just intuitive sense. And we don't have that sense just because knowledge is a good thing, which it is. We don't have that sense because we want to live after death, necessarily. But we just have that sense that in and of itself, it would be good to have some kind of understanding of and relationship with transcendent reality or ultimate reality or whatever more than human source of reality and meaning there might be. Even an atheist wants to have some, you know, understanding of whatever more than human source of reality there might be. And this kind of sense that it would be good to have that sense or that understanding, that relationship, is religion, and it is a basic good in the sense that we don't seek that good in order to achieve some other good behind it. It's not a mere means. Human beings everywhere always have had a sense that it would really be important for their flourishing to have this kind of sense and kind of relationship that I'm talking about. So that's part of the moral case, that if religion is such a distinctive, unique, irreducible component of human flourishing, a good in itself, not a mere means to some other good, but actually good in itself, then that means that people need to be given the space to achieve whatever amount, to speak crudely, whatever amount of that good they can, or whatever kind of understanding of ultimate reality they can. And they need to have space because Nobody can impose that kind of good on someone else. I mean, there are some things actually we can be forced to have that may even be good for us. I mean, if I, you know, if I refuse to feed myself, it's possible for people to take it upon themselves to you know, force me to be fed intravenously, for example. I mean, I can be forced to have certain goods imposed on me. But religion is not that kind of good because it's intrinsically dependent on activating my own reason and my own will. I mean, I can't have someone force an understanding of ultimate reality on me, because any force would bypass my own understanding and my own will.
Now, let me break in here. And
yeah.
This report is not only aimed at U.S. policymakers, but it basically has a very broad appeal to the entire planet, all of human civilization. How would you answer a critic that says, oh, that notion of religion as an innate good that cannot be forced upon you is culturally bounded? I mean, that's just a Western notion,
yeah.
Not only of religion, but even that Western notion of liberty.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't think that's true. And I think there are a lot of reasons to think that's not true. You know, we do have a number of records of various civilizations recognizing that it was wrong to not tolerate a variety of religious beliefs. I think based on this idea that this is such an intimate and personal kind of good that it can't be forced. You have the Persian Empire recognizing and promulgating edicts of toleration. You have the Emperor Ashoka in India promulgating edicts of religious toleration. And as I know we'll talk about a little more, you have in the record of the deepest sources of the Islamic tradition a recognition that a religion is something that can't be compelled. You have the earliest church fathers, pre-modern thinkers in North Africa, you know, way before, you know, ideas of liberty that we take to be distinctive of the West were developed in any systematic way. You had these early church fathers saying that, no, religion is something you cannot coerce. So I think this idea that I'm talking about is not in any way peculiarly Christian or Western or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's that's very clear and something we try to say in the report.
And you do this by following up the moral case, which would be the general moral case that could be made by a secular humanist, for instance,
yeah,
on why we do this, but follow it up with three religious traditions and how,
yeah,
they view that. And that was also a very powerful part of the conference as well. And so you have three chapters, one on,
yep,
Judaism, written by David Novak, one on Christianity,
yep,
written by Nicholas Wolterstorff, and then one on Islam by Abdullah Saeed. Let's go ahead and walk through those and give me the justifications that each of these faith traditions has for religious liberty. Let's start with Judaism.
Sure. David Novak and Nicholas Wolterstorff and Abdullah Saeed all wrote, you know, wonderful essays, and they're incredible because, you know, as you would have seen, each one is extremely short. We gave them an impossible task, which I think we essentially said, you know, please give us, you know, the heart of what your religious tradition says about religious liberty in 500 words or less. And, you know, they all were a little over 500 words, but not much more. So they're incredibly pithy and yet powerful, substantive, rich statements. David Novak argues many, many things in his very short essay. For example, he says that we know that Jewish communities did not force the Jewish covenant on non-Jews that lived among them. There was, you know, as long as non-Jews didn't practice very conspicuous idolatry, essentially any non-Jew could live perfectly peacefully and happily among non-Jews. So in practice, Jewish communities, you know, very much tended to practice a kind of, you know, religious freedom and toleration of non-Jews. More deeply, David Novak says at the very heart of the Jewish tradition is the idea that, that our relationship with God is governed by a covenant, a quasi kind of nuptial or marital relationship that involves freedom on both sides, just as marriage, understood, as a relationship between two adults, freely entered into, properly speaking, that our relationship with God is one that begins with His election, His uncoerced choice of a particular people, but that people, in the whole way the covenant is framed, the whole way the covenant is talked about from the calling of Abram onwards, presupposes a free, uncoerced response on the part of people who are invited into that relationship. So that's the heart of the case that David Novak makes, that the entire structure of the Jewish covenant is really predicated on freedom.
Yeah, it gets to that whole issue of free will and the idea of covenant as a contract. And yeah. Hey, you don't have to take this contract. You can be complete idiots and not accept it. And, in part, that's religious history, Jewish history.
That's right. You're given a clear choice, and there are clear consequences. Yeah. It's not, in that sense, one could say that it's not a real choice, but it really is framed as mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
There is a freedom to respond and to respond as one will.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's not thrust on people, but people are told exactly sort of what's in the contract. They're told what the consequences will be on both sides, good and bad. What their obligations are, all of which presupposes that the recipients of it are full-fledged human beings, with will and freedom, and who have dignity and who are not children, but adults who can freely respond or not.
Well, take us through Nicholas Walterstorff's argument, and he argues from the Christian perspective.
Yeah, Professor Walterstorff makes a number of arguments. I think he makes four different arguments in his little essay. One of the first arguments he makes is that the Christian tradition has consistently taught that God is not interested in coerced worship. That you see this from the beginning in the preaching of Christ, that in his preaching against the Pharisees, for example, that God's not interested in people going through the motions of ritual. God is interested in your heart, and nobody can coerce your heart. Nobody can tell you to make you love God. Nobody can force you to worship God in any way that God's interested in. So that's one of the main, consistent thrusts of the Christian tradition, that worship that's not free is not worship. Faith that's not free is really not faith.
Mm-hmm.
Another argument of the Christian tradition is a kind of argument, kind of a natural rights argument based on human beings' natural duties to the Creator. Human beings have a kind of duty to know the truth and to express the truth as they see it about God, that it's a fundamental duty, and because it's a fundamental duty, people have to have fundamental rights. That in order to discharge our duty to seek and know and express the truth about God, we need a certain amount of space, a certain amount of freedom. And interestingly, this kind of natural rights argument that human beings have a natural right to freely seek the truth and freely worship God is not an invention of the Enlightenment or the Protestant Reformation, but Nicholas Walterstorff's essay makes it clear that it really goes back to probably Tertullian, the church father from North Africa, writing in the very, very late second century and the early third century. He argues that astonishingly, he says that it is a fundamental human right and a privilege of nature to worship God according to our own will. So this idea goes very deep in the Christian tradition.
Now I'm starting to see a pattern developing here that, along with the Jewish idea of free will or of a covenant, I should say, and Christianity is saying you Christians are not coerced to worship. Mm-hmm. That issue becomes important, and I want to move this to Islam because. Yes. You know, for many of my listeners who are in North America, you know, we don't have a great deal of contact with Islam, and we would seem to be watching the news, and you'd see, you know, people who have converted from Islam to Christianity being charged with apostasy in Iran, the recent case of Pastor Yusuf Nadarkhani.
Yep.
And so we would say, hey, this has got to be a tough sell in Islam. How does the Islamic tradition, as represented by Abdullah Saeed, view religious liberty?
Abdullah Saeed argues, along with, by the way, other very important, influential Muslim scholars who are steeped in the classical tradition, scholars like Hamza Yusuf, who is the co-founder of Zaytuna College in California. Abdullah Saeed argues that the heart of the Muslim tradition really does respect religious freedom because the heart of Islam is the idea that every person should freely submit themselves to the will of Allah, the will of God. Of course, Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. Allah is not some different kind of God like Vishnu or something. But in fact, Christian Arabs use the word Allah before Islam even existed. So the heart of Islam is simply to submit one's will to the will of God. And it's obvious that you can't genuinely submit your will to God or anything else if you're not free. I mean, if someone is forcing you to submit your will to God, you're not submitting your will to God. You're submitting your will to whoever is forcing you to do that. It's not submission to God. It's submission to some coercive bully. So, in a sense, that's kind of the heart of the Muslim case for religious freedom. Now, as you said, there's this special issue, though, about apostasy, and it does seem that there are parts of the Muslim tradition that require very harsh punishment for apostates, even the death penalty.
You're free to enter, but maybe not free to leave.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, and that's what some Muslim scholars have argued. Abdullah Saeed argues that the case for insisting that apostasy must be punished with death really rests not on anything in the Quran. That's one key point. There's nothing in the Quran that teaches or requires anything about any kind of earthly temporal punishment for apostasy. Nothing at all. The only basis for the teaching comes from one or two hadith, which are the sayings of the Prophet Abdullah Saeed. And this is where people should go look at the book, because Abdullah Saeed makes a detailed case. And in fact, in a book that he's written actually on Islam and apostasy, which people should also look at,
you can link to that. Yeah,
or this, yeah, in even greater length. And his basic argument is that these hadith are either not that reliable, or they can be explained by the fact that they refer to a very particular brief period in the life of the Prophet. When the so-called crime of apostasy was really feared and opposed, because it was tantamount to a direct attack on what was then an extremely vulnerable, persecuted community. An apostate in that very, very limited context of a very particular period in the Prophet's life was someone who left this very embattled community and was a direct and immediate traitor to that embattled community. In his view, whatever sayings seem to support apostasy in general really have to be explained in that context. It's, you know, in sort of the way that, you know, many Christians try to explain texts in Paul concerning, you know, whether women should, you know, should teach. You know, Paul in Timothy says, you know, I suffer not a woman to teach. Well, you know, there's a lot of good reason to think that passages like that need to be understood in light of very, very, very specific context. And that's essentially what Abdel-Hafid argues about the passages concerning concerning apostasy. And of course, you know, in the Christian tradition as well, Christianity, for most of the history of Christianity, more than 1,000 years, Christians were absolutely persuaded that apostates from Christianity should be treated exactly the same way that some Muslim scholars have said apostates should be treated from Islam. Mm-hmm. Apostates or heretics, for Thomas Aquinas, deserve to be separated from the world by death. That was the view of Calvin. It was the view of Martin Luther. It was the view of, or the later Martin Luther. You know, it was a kind of universal consensus of the Christian tradition, based on the reading of a certain rather isolated text in the New Testament. So, I mean, my own view is that if it's possible for the Christian tradition to exercise a kind of, you know, hermeneutic that interprets relatively minor passages in light of the more major tenets and the more important doctrines, I don't see why it's impossible for the Muslim tradition to do the same thing. And mm-hmm. it seems quite persuasive to me that that the heart of the Muslim faith, this idea of free submission to the will of God, really requires religious liberty, and that these more minor issues should be interpreted in light of that more important teaching.
One of the things that struck me in this conference and also reading this is how much similarity there are between these different faith traditions in terms of their justifications for religious liberty, which is very heartening because it gives the possibility that the issue of religious liberty is transcendent above cultural, ethnic, and religious boundaries.
Absolutely. This whole idea that there is a sovereign God, authority, that is above the state, you know, to whom we owe an obedience higher than the state, that is such a radical notion, and it means that we have, I think, far more in common with respect to, you know, this issue of religious liberty with our Jewish and Muslim friends than many people realize.
Yeah, I would agree completely on that, but that's the moral case for religious liberty. Yes. Now here's the tough sell, selling this to politicians. And so I step back to this issue of trying to create a political justification for this. And this is things that I've been very interested in writing about. And I see religious liberty, or at least I've written on it in terms of, you know, hey, religious liberty is good for political business. It's good for economics. It's good for politicians. Yeah. But that's oftentimes...
And you show that it's only when politicians... realize that yes. you actually get traction.
Yeah, and that's the hard sell, because one of the issues that politicians or rulers throughout history are concerned about is like, whoa, if we get a lot of very different people within our political boundaries, it's just going to be chaos. There's going to be fighting. I mean, talk about India, what we were just talking about at the beginning of the podcast. You have some Muslims here. You have some Hindus here. There's some Christians over there. Wow, everybody's fighting, blowing up trains. It's a mess. Well, you can understand why politicians would be very wary and have historically been very wary of religious liberty and indeed liberty of other sorts. So what's the political case to be made for religious liberty?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that in a way the heart of the political case, or at least one part of the political case, let's say one very important part is the argument from human dignity, which I'd wanted to say a little more about earlier, but I was talking too much, so I didn't have a chance to make this point.
Now's your chance.
Earlier, but I think that is actually part of the political case. That, and I think we assume this with respect to a whole host of other issues like torture. I mean, why do why why is there a kind of, you know, why has there been an increasing consensus that you shouldn't torture people? You know, even when there may be a good reason to do so. Well, it's just wrong. You know, it's as simple as that, that there are just certain things, certain ways of treating people that are so incompatible with respecting their worth and their dignity that you just don't do them. I mean, even if you might get something out of it, you don't do it. I think the heart of the case, the political case for religious liberty, is that that applies here. That because of the many things we've already said about the moral case and about the basic good of religion and about its naturalness and so forth, but also because of this idea of human dignity, to try to manipulate, coerce people is really to treat them as having less dignity than they have. It's to treat them as either slaves, or to treat them as the equivalent of children, as kind of wards of the government or some religious community. People as people who are really less than adult in either their reason or their will or their character whatever. And that it's just wrong to manipulate, coerce, disrespect, force people to go against their religious convictions. That, by the way, is the big issue we're dealing with now with respect to the Health and Human Services mandate. We don't need to get into the specifics of that, but what's at issue for people who are concerned about it is a feeling that the government is directly requiring people, literally requiring religious institutions to do things and pay for things that directly violate their religious convictions. And that is to violate their dignity. It's to treat them as if they don't have the capacity to make judgments about these very important matters. And that the judgments that they make are just not important enough to respect. So the heart of the argument about dignity is that it's not just the kind of the side effects of violating people's religious liberty that matter. It's not just that oftentimes people are physically abused when their religious freedom is violated. It's not just that they're freedom of speech is violated. It's not, in other words, religious liberty in and of itself is important. And, you know, I think the one way to appreciate that is to imagine if it were possible to invent a drug that could painlessly and cleanly cause people to have their religious beliefs either disappear or change in some way that one would want. Would it be wrong to introduce such a drug or treatment or chemical, say in the water supply, if someone wanted to, you know, cause a whole population to revert to, you know, a single religious point of view? As you were saying earlier, you know, politicians often want their whole community to have the same religious point of view. Wouldn't it be so much easier, you know, if people didn't have these horrible religious disagreements? We'd have, you know, so much more harmony, and we would be one, you know, community. What if you could, you know, make people believe all the same thing without causing any pain, without any imprisonment, without any torture? And the point about dignity is that it would still be wrong, that it would be wrong, just as wrong in a way, because you would be treating people in a way that bypasses what gives them dignity or what a major part of what gives them dignity, their capacity for their own self-direction and reasoning and will. It bypasses their agency in a way that fundamentally disrespects them, and it also deprives them, cuts them off from any possibility of achieving this basic good, their own understanding of a harmony with ultimate reality. So, you know, I think we shouldn't separate the, you know, in a sense, part of the moral case, this case from human dignity, from the political case. That I think we, you know, we have a sense that ultimately political communities that don't respect human dignity are in serious trouble, that they're probably not viable in the long run, and are not really going to be legitimate. But there's a whole other set of arguments, which, you know, we can now go into, which, and it's based on research that people like Brian Grimm have done, which, and you've done as well, that religious freedom is consistently correlated with a whole host of economic and political goods. And just one, you know, illustration of this is an illustration, you could say, from Western history. It's often called the first freedom, religious freedom. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, you know, one of the things we mean by that is that the whole Western idea of a free society really emerged from the idea that the church was supposed to be a sphere of society that the government couldn't completely control, that the church was one sphere of society that the state, the prince, the emperor, whoever it was, had to regard as sacrosanct. Of course, governments often didn't actually respect that, but the insistence of popes and bishops and churches, often at the cost of their lives, that no, you have to respect this distinct sphere as autonomous. This kind of forced Western societies to, you know, often very grudgingly recognize that the state was limited, that the government didn't have supreme power and authority over everything. And the Magna Carta, which we, you know, look back on as the founding kind of original, you know, cornerstone of Western ideas of limited government, the very first clause of the Magna Carta is what? That King John had to respect the rights and liberties of the church. So, in a way, religious freedom really is the first freedom, not just because of historical priority, but a political society that doesn't respect religious freedom first isn't going to respect the idea that government has to be limited.
Mm-hmm. I just got to step back and talk about that little thought experiment that you had with the pill. If we introduced this into the water and, yeah, right. And everybody had no conflict, then a lot of people would imagine that that's a really great world to live in if everybody thought alike. But I start to think that world would really suck because everybody would be the same. Yeah. And the fact that certain benefits come out of diversity and pluralism in the interaction, which sometimes can be very conflictual, but you know, a lot of good things can come from that process. And
absolutely. Absolutely. And, Rodney Stark's work, of course, has shown that, as you know, when people are forced to be in a kind of religiously pluralistic environment, that's actually good for religious communities.
Yeah, they all get along, and they have to work hard to cultivate their flock. The other thing, just as a side note, you had mentioned the health mandate. And I know you're at Georgetown University, and Georgetown has kind of become the center of that conflict recently. But I just need to note for some of our listeners who might be out in the DC area that the Berkeley Center on Religion, Peace, and World Affairs is actually sponsoring a debate on that. I think it's March 23rd.
Yes, 22nd.
Right, next
week. Yep, that's right.
Yeah. And so I'm not sure if this will be airing after that date, but we will link to that, and hopefully we'll get one or two of the participants from that on our podcast here.
Great.
So put in a plug for that. That leads me to the one of the last questions here that I have. We're talking about political justifications for this, and this leads us to the world of strategic considerations, because this book, again, is aimed at policymakers, and we spent a lot of time at the Princeton conference talking about how do we get the State Department bureaucrats to take this seriously, to push this agenda. How do you make that case that religious liberty is in the national interest, knowing that sometimes we have to subvert our more noble goals in order to achieve our national interest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's often, you know, we're often told, well, you know, there are more important things, and you know, we have to be strategic, we've got to be realist. In a way, I think it is the height of unrealism to not take religious freedom seriously. In other words, a realist approach to the world is the first kind of approach that should recognize that religious liberty, you know, should be an important part of our foreign policy strategy and a very important foreign policy priority. Why do I say that? I mean, let's do another thought experiment. What if the United States had really been on the side of promoting religious freedom over the last 50 years in the Middle East? What if we, in Egypt and in Iran and in Syria and in Tunisia and in Algeria, what if we were on the forefront of saying, you know what, we've been supporting you guys, you dictatorial regimes, you sultans, who, you know, have run roughshod over human rights people. You know what? We're not going to do that anymore. We think that all the different groups in your society, including Islamic groups, including groups we may not particularly like, that these groups shouldn't be forced to, you know, underground. They should be permitted to compete for influence. They should be allowed to have their own civil society institutions, even form their own political parties, so long as they renounce violence. I would bet that the results of such a policy would compare very, very favorably to the results of the policy that we had, in fact, conducted over the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. So what did we get for, you know, supporting repressive regimes, which supposedly was in our interest? You know, we supported the Shah of Iran. What did we get?
Islamic Revolution.
We supported a highly repressive secularist government because we thought that was the wave of the future, because we thought, well, he was kind of, you know, putting Iran on a fast track towards modernity. And we thought, well, he was our, you know, he was on our side. And we supported Sadat and Mubarak. And, you know, were happy when they repressed the Muslim Brotherhood. And we were fine about Bourguiba in Tunisia and Ben Ali, you know, repressing Muslims there. Well, what did it get us? And we were fine about the Algerian government, you know, canceling the second round of elections and preventing Islamists from coming into power in the early 1990s. What did that get? That got a bloodbath in Algeria that, you know, killed hundreds of thousands of people over the course of 10 years and helped incubate, you know, greater radicalism. So I'm not saying at all that a policy that says, well, let's let all these religious groups into the open doesn't have risks. It's very risky, and you've written about this far more than I have, that yes, introducing religious diversity and competition in societies is destabilizing. It does have risk. Sometimes you have dangerous groups. The only point about religious freedom is that it's better.
Yeah.
Not great. It may not even be good, but it's less dangerous. It's less harmful. It's less risky. Just, you know, and here we're speaking purely strategically, you know, and in a kind of realist mode. I mean, we've already talked about other arguments for why you should respect religious freedom, but if we're talking purely on realist strategic grounds, I perfectly grant that, you know, there are risks. You know, there are risks in having a completely free and kind of open laissez-faire religious economy in Egypt today. Because we know now that the Muslim Brotherhood and the even more radical Salafist groups, they do represent lots of people. But we also know something else. We do know that given time, societies do tend to work out a kind of equilibrium. That given time, for one thing, we do know from political science that Islamists always do much better in the first set of elections after a democratic transition than subsequent elections. So probably, you know, the vote that the Muslim groups got, the Islamist groups got in Egypt, is probably the best they're going to do.
Yeah, you know? One thing you mentioned, I think it's a very good point, is that once religious groups ascend to power, one, it forces them to moderate, because
exactly,
ruling a country is very difficult. And then when they tie themselves, I mean, they're usually religious groups have to deal with the transcendental, but when they tie themselves to something in the here and now, material world, people find out that you can't always get the trains to run on time and have the garbage picked up on time. And people start to disrespect your ability to govern in the here and now, and start to wonder about your ability to tell them about the thereafter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A perfect case of this is India. You know, so we can go back to what, you know, I was talking about when I talked about what personally led me to an interest in religious freedom. You know, India is a, you know, very imperfect democracy, but it's still a democracy. It has a very imperfect respect for religious freedom, but by and large, for a country of that size, with that much diversity, it has, you know, at least with respect to government policy, it has a pretty decent respect for religious freedom. It's certainly better than a lot of other countries in the world. And Muslims in India have more freedom than they have in many, many other Muslim-majority countries. And because of the freedom and democracy and religious liberty that basically exists in India, you've had very dangerous religious movements. The Hindu nationalist movement in India is a movement that in many ways is very dangerous, and it was involved in the terrible pogrom I mentioned that killed 2,000 Muslims 10 years ago. But because of India's basically free democratic system, that party has had to moderate. That movement has to compete for votes. What happened in the western state of Gujarat in India 10 years ago has not been repeated in other parts of India, at least not to that extent. And because of a free system in which other Hindu groups can rise up to challenge the Hindu nationalist movement and other non-Hindu groups can challenge it and can compete, because they have the freedom to argue against the Hindu nationalist movement, the Hindu nationalist movement has declined in the last 6, 7, 8 years. They lost power at the center in 2004, and they've not been able to form a government, a national government since then. And yes, they've done well in certain states, but they've also lost ground in certain states. In other words, India has achieved, you know, a not perfect, yes, it's messy, but it's better than a system that completely repressed the Hindu nationalist movement, because I guarantee that would be far worse. Those people, that movement, would be even more dangerous if you tried to drive them underground. So nobody should act like religious freedom is a wonderful, you know, panacea, so that when, you know, whenever you introduce it, you know, there'll be peace and harmony and rainbows, and you know that's not it at all. But you know, government and policy is always about making tough choices. So the question is it better than the alternative? And I think our argument and the, you know, evidence we provide in the book suggests that it's a much better way to go than, you know, any of the leading alternatives. And of course, we should also recognize, you know, religious freedom is never an absolute. There are specific circumstances and conditions which perfectly justify some limits on religious freedom. Sometimes there are groups that are violent that shouldn't be given, you know, complete free rein. You do have to, of course, have limits under certain circumstances. But again, compared to the alternatives, it is a very wise, very strategic course of action.
And I couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. I think that's a pretty good lesson to leave off with here as we're running out of time. But I invite people to pick up the very reasonably priced, pithy booklet that is really packed. It's filled with a lot of wisdom, a lot of knowledge, a lot of great arguments. It's called Religious Freedom, Why Now? Defending an Embattled Human Right. And it is authored by our guest today, Timothy Shaw. And I got to follow up with this, because when I was out there at Princeton, I gave perhaps one of the more unusual talks. Most memorable, I guess. That's what I'm good at. I'm very good at making an impression, even though it doesn't have any substance to it. But
and that's why you're quoted in the book, by the way, which you didn't mention.
I did.
You got one of the few block quotes in the whole book.
I know. I was very impressed with that. I went back and I saw that, and so I was very impressed. Thank you for that site. But one of the things that, you know, after I finished this talk and you know, for people who don't know, I started off with this little prayer about, please don't anybody use big words like ontology like we've been using before, because I can't figure out what that stuff is. I finished this talk. I walked away from it. I went up to Thomas Farr and I said, Thomas, I just pretty much guaranteed that I'll never be invited to the East Coast again. He says, no, we've got to have you back. So, and any near future visits for me to Witherspoon or Berkeley Center in the future?
Oh, you bet.
All right.
Absolutely. We're going to exploit you to the full.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. And again, our guest today has been Timothy Shaw, who has written a number of things, and the most recent was Religious Freedom, Why Now? Defending an Embattled Human Right. Tim, it's been great having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Tony. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.